6 inches, a high of 28, winds up to 20 miles per hour, some higher gusts. Currently, wind north at 15, gusting to 24. Snowing, 26 in Racine and Kenosha, wind chill plus 9. At 10 past 8, I'm Dave McGrath. The Morning Show with Greg Berg is next.
And we welcome you to the Monday Morning Show on WGTD. I'm Gregory Berg. Today we are replaying one of our favorite morning show interviews from 2024. As I begin this interview, it is National Banned Books Week, and it is an important opportunity for all of us as Americans to be thinking about the way in which books are an important part of our lives and our culture and community, and why the right to read what we want to read is a fundamental right that we need to be very careful to defend. That is one of the themes of a wonderful new book, which I have been so thoroughly enjoying, titled Why Books Still Matter. Honoring Joyce Meskis, Essays on the Past, Present, and Future of Books, Bookselling, and Publishing. The name in the subtitle, Joyce Meskis, refers to an amazing force of nature, a woman who founded one of the most famous and lauded independent bookstores in the country, the Tattered Covered Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. And she was, beyond just that, also an incredibly powerful positive force in the whole sector of librarians and booksellers and the publishing industry, appreciating in an exceptional way the importance of all of us having access to the books that could help change our lives and change our country for that matter. And what has been gathered together in this wonderful new book is an array of essays honoring the legacy of the late Joyce Meskis and also talking about books, book selling, book publishing, and the way in which this part of our lives has changed rather dramatically over recent years. The editor of this book, Why Books Still Matter, is Carl Weber, who is the publisher of Rivertowns Books, which is the publisher of this particular book. He has worked in the book publishing world for 4 decades or more, including stints with Wiley and Random House, and he is director of the editing workshop at the Denver Publishing Institute. And his handiwork is evident in this beautifully crafted book titled, once again, Why Books Still Matter. Carl Weber, we welcome you to the morning show.
Greg, what an amazing introduction. Thank you.
My eyes lit up when I saw the fancy word Festschrift at the beginning of your book. A few years ago, I would have had no idea what that term meant, but I happen to be a columnist for the Journal of Singing, which is the scholarly publication of the National Association of Teachers of Singing. And a few years ago, our then editor, Richard Seardsma, wanted to devote a volume of the Journal of Singing to honor a great voice teacher by the name of Richard Miller. And he, conversant, fluent in German, utilized the term Festschrift. And that's what that entire volume was, including my column and everything else in that particular volume were in one way or another dedicated to honoring this particular person. Likewise, your book, Why Books Still Matter, is a Festschrift. Explain what prompted you to want to put this together and also a little bit about how you put it together.
Greg, I'm sitting here grinning because I love the fact that you latched onto that word, which is also a favorite of mine. And I get a big kick out of the fact that you're clearly not only a book lover, but also a lover of the written and spoken word. And so I think you and I have a lot in common. Let me tell you, I'll tell you a little bit about my relationship with Joyce Meskis, what made her such a special person, and why many friends of Joyce and joined together with me to do this book, this Festschrift, to honor her. Joyce was an amazing bookseller. She created what's now known as the book superstore concept. So if you've ever gone into a bookstore that has more than one story dedicated to books, there are hundreds of thousands of different titles available in every conceivable genre and subject matter. There's a cafe. There are comfortable sofas and chairs everywhere. So you can grab a stack of books from the shelves and sit down and browse to your heart's content. If you've ever been in a bookstore like that and luxuriated at being surrounded by a temple dedicated to the written word, then you've benefited from Joyce Meskis's entrepreneurial creativity, because the Tattered Cover was the first bookstore in the country to fit that model. And she was also a hero of the First Amendment. Joyce and the Tattered Cover were actually plaintiffs in a couple of landmark cases, including one that went all the way to the Colorado Supreme Court, and which ultimately affirmed for the first time a constitutional right for readers to read any books that they want to order from their local bookstore without the government having access to their purchase records. So the principle that you should be able to read whatever you want without feeling Big Brother looking over your shoulder is something that Joyce Meskis and her lawsuit helped to define for all of us. So when she passed away at the end of 2022, I did call on her family and friends and said, let's do a book to honor Joyce. Not a biography, although that would be really interesting, but knowing Joyce, she would have wanted the spotlight to be on her life's work and on the things that she valued so deeply and dedicated her life to, which includes free expression, the importance of books in our culture and in our society. And so I have pulled together contributions by a wide array of distinguished folks talking about those themes. And it's been a labor of love. And now to have the opportunity to share the book and talk about it with people like you, it has just been a lifelong dream come true.
I don't remember who it is. It might be Matthew Miller, a longtime employee at the Tattered Cover Bookstore, who called Joyce Meskis a modest, fiercely determined, public-spirited woman. And that seems like a really apt turn of phrase to describe this extraordinary woman and all that she managed to accomplish during her life.
Yes, I agree. The mission that she set out for herself and for everyone who worked at the Tattered Cover was to put the right book into the hands of the right person. If you do that, then you're doing your work as a bookseller, and that's a mission that all of us in publishing, editors, publishers, marketers, salespeople, all of us are dedicated to, and to make America a nation of happy and engaged readers is that's our lifelong mission.
I don't think I've mentioned this yet, but I had the privilege and pleasure of visiting the Tattered Cover Bookstore back in the spring of 1992 on my honeymoon. and I think it was mentioned in the guidebook to Denver that my wife and I had purchased to help us figure out what exciting places to visit in Denver. And even having read wonderful things about it and already being a lover of bookstores, nevertheless, I was not prepared for that amazing store. I mean, how huge it was, how beautiful and comfortable it was, and all that was there. I walked out of there with 9 or 10 books and that I purchased. And I remember one of them being a biography of Kurt Browning, who at that point in time was one of the world's finest figure skaters. And this was a book published in Canada that I didn't even know existed. And, of course, that was part of the glory of a place like the Tattered Cover Bookstore, was that you could walk in there and explore the shelves and find books that you would not have even looked for because you didn't know they existed in the first place. And that experience of nearly unlimited discovery, I should think that's maybe at the heart and soul of what it, why it was such a joyous experience to visit a place like the Tattered Cover Bookstore.
Right, that's exactly right. And, you know, bookstores, libraries, and the classroom actually are places that, you know, so many of us have had our lives and our minds and our hearts changed and opened up by the serendipity of discovering something that we didn't realize was going to become important to us. And so, you know, one of the themes of the book is book banning, why it is such a threat, particularly today, to all of us, and why we need to push back against it. And, you know, at the heart of that issue of book banning and the freedom to get access to all kinds of books is the idea of making it possible for people of every background, people of all ages, from kids to elder folks like ourselves, to be able to experience that kind of serendipity of discovering ideas, experiences, ways of life, ways of thinking that we never imagined, but which are there to enrich the way we experience life. And in a nation as diverse and amazing as the United States, for us to be able to have access to the experiences and ideas and thoughts of people of every background, that's such an amazing privilege that we all need to take advantage of. And great bookstores, great libraries, these are places where that can happen as long as the book banners don't get their way.
For those of you just joining us, I am speaking with Carl Weber, who is editor of a newly published book called Why Books Still Matter, honoring Joyce Meskis' essays on the past, present, and future of books, bookselling, and publishing. Joyce Meskis, who is mentioned in the subtitle of the book, was an incredible woman who lived and worked in Denver for many, many decades, and founded the Tattered Cover Bookstore, which really helped reshape the whole business of where and how books were sold in this country. In fact, I wonder if we could talk for a moment about the kind of landscape that Joyce Meskis was entering when she created this store, or purchased it, I should say, back in 1974, when it was not what it was going to become. I think it's in chapter 9 of the book, Catalyzing a Revolution in Book Marketing, where we're told about what a bookstore typically was in the United States in the early 1970s, if you visited your local mall. And I have to confess to have nearly completely forgotten about the kind of bookstores that most of us were visiting back in those days. Remind our listeners about that.
Well, it's true that prior to the advent of the book superstore, the revolution that Joyce Meskis helped to catalyze, prior to that, the kind of selection that the average reader would have access to in a typical bookstore was very small. You have New York Times bestsellers and a handful of other, you know, classic books that were available, and books in a few genre categories, and that was pretty much it. It was the typical bookstore was small, and unless a book had a major publishing effort put behind it by one of the handful of big publishers, chances were good that you wouldn't be able to find it in your local store. It
right.
might take days to get one ordered for you. And so the access to ideas and experiences were much more limited. And the advent of the superstore, and later, of course, the internet and other technological advances, have made it possible for all of us to get access to a much wider array of ideas and information than ever before.
Right. The author of this particular chapter 9, Carl Lennertz, I believe, used to work in a Walden bookstore. And, of course, Walden and B. Dalton would be the small bookstores that one would typically find in a local mall. And he writes at one point in talking about kind of the mass market personality of these kind of chains. He writes, I started out at Walden, and one of my jobs was refilling the upfront floor displays of mass market paperbacks. Those upfront displays were called, he says, unfortunately or regrettably, dumps. You would dump these incredibly inexpensive and paperbacks, and then you'd take a few copies out of the shelves or out of the racks to make it look like people have been in there and, you know, taking some. But it's just so interesting to think about how, for many people, that was the whole world of books that you could purchase, and that there just weren't the avenues that are available now in terms of accessing an incredibly wide range of possibilities.
Mm-hmm. And one of the beauties of the independent bookstore, especially the great ones like Joyce's store, is that they attract a caliber of employee who can play an important role in bringing great books to the attention of their customers, so that the independent bookstore has book lovers on their staff. They're not just sort of people filling a job. They're people who are immersed in the world of books and who also understand the community. They understand the kinds of interests of the folks who come into the store, so that when you get to know the people at your local independent bookstore, chances are the second and third and fourth time you walk in, one of them is going to greet you and say, oh, we've got a couple of new arrivals that are perfect for you. And you'll discover all kinds of books that you would never have dreamed of, because there's someone with an eye for quality and someone who is deeply immersed in what's coming out of the publishing houses, not just the big five, but also the small indie publishers that are publishing niche products that have an important market, but which are not going to necessarily turn up on the New York Times bestseller list. So the independent bookstore is really a tremendous conduit and a tool for book lovers to make those kinds of life-changing discoveries that is one of the reasons we all love books.
Right. And, of course, one thing that also is mentioned in Carl Ennerts's essay is that Joyce Meskis led the way in the early to mid-1970s, but it's in a sense, no coincidence that is when she emerges, because Carl Ennerts points to this as an incredibly exciting era in which, for the first time, the almost completely male-dominated world of book publishing and book selling begins to be invigorated by the presence of more and more women. He says at one point, you know, the names read like a hall of fame of important women in the world of books. But leading the way in so many respects was this Joyce Meskis. Tell us a little bit more about her background before the story of the tattered covered bookstore.
Well, Joyce had an amazing entrepreneurial mindset. One of my favorite chapters in Why Books Still Matter is by John Hickenlooper, the U.S. Senator from Colorado, who was a business partner of Joyce's. John first rose to fame as the proprietor of the first brewpub in Denver. And it's very interesting. James Fallows, the political columnist, has written a lot about Jimmy Carter, who he served as a speechwriter. And one of Jimmy Carter's little-known achievements was reforming the beer production licensing rules, which made small local independent brew pubs popular. And John Hickenlooper took advantage of this to create a very popular watering hole in Denver, which helped to revitalize the surrounding neighborhood. And in his chapter in the book, John Hickenlooper talks about how he and Joyce Meskis became good friends, and how John learned so much about creating successful businesses and making them anchors for thriving communities from Joyce. So Joyce brought to bookselling an incredible sense of dedication to customer service. She had a week-long training program for new employees who were paid full salary for a week of doing nothing but taking lessons in how to be a great bookseller, how to make sure books are properly stocked, how to answer customer questions, how to never make a customer feel as though you're looking down on their choice of book, whether it's a hot new romance or a scholarly book by a Harvard professor. So Joyce Mesk has brought this amazing entrepreneurial spirit to bookselling, which she then passed on to other booksellers around the country. And one of the things that we find when we actually study how communities develop is that one of the key anchors to a thriving downtown neighborhood is a great independent bookstore. There have been many studies showing that when a good independent store opens up on a particular street, that street tends to develop other great businesses, the foot traffic begins to increase, the level of safety and the level of prosperity for the entire community increases. So Joyce Mesk brought that creativity to bookselling, and it had tremendous benefits for all the communities that now benefit from similar types of stores.
I'm so glad that you mentioned this particular chapter, Chapter 3, written by now U.S. Senator John Hickenlooper, former mayor of Denver, former governor of Colorado. And this is a chapter titled The Bookseller as Entrepreneur, Joyce Mesk and Her Mission. And one of the things that he describes in this chapter is the first time that they actually met, although at that point he very much knew who she was, having been a frequent visitor to the Tattered Covered Bookstore. But I think their first meeting was when she actually came to his brew pub. And he quotes Joyce Mesk at that first visit as saying, "I like this brew pub. I think she starts out by saying this, I didn't expect this at all. I like this. It looks like something someone from the neighborhood would create." And I mean, what a brilliant observation, what a great way to put it. And in a sense, the two of them seem to share a whole lot of similarities in terms of the way they saw the world and their community and the way in which to be a meaningful part of that community.
Yes, it's so true. And one of the wonderful experiences that I had in working on the book was getting to know a number of other independent bookstore proprietors who have imbibed so much of that same spirit. For example, one of the chapters in the book is by Richard Howorth, who is a legendary bookseller in his own right down in Oxford, Mississippi, which is readers will know that name because it's the home of William Faulkner, one of America's greatest novelists. And after graduating from college, Richard Howorth realized that his hometown of Oxford, Mississippi, did not have a great bookstore. And so he moved back home, started one, and the bookstore that he created now occupies several storefronts right around the downtown square of Oxford, Mississippi. And in fact, it's called Square Books. And Richard Howorth took so many leadership lessons from Joyce Mesk about how to make the bookstore a crucial cultural center for the community and how to bring that spirit of entrepreneurship and leadership to bookselling that he ended up running for mayor of Oxford and served a couple of terms quite successfully in that role. So booksellers are playing important roles in their community in more ways than one.
Absolutely. And one of the things that we see in this chapter, mention is made of it, and then we turn the page, and then here it is something that he put together, he and his wife, that was essentially posted and distributed at their establishment, Square Books in Oxford. And at the top, this headline, "All are welcome here." And I want to just read at least some of this, if you don't mind, just because I think it speaks, I think, so powerfully to the sense of mission that is so often a part of these kind of independent bookstores. So we see at the top, the banner headline, "All are welcome here." Below we read, "Buddhists, Jews, Christians, Muslims, and atheists are welcome here, as are gay, lesbian, transgender, and heterosexual people, Republicans, Democrats, socialists, Marxists, Tea Party members, communists, unreconstructed Southerners, and Yankees are welcome here. Our doors are open to men, women, and children, whether Chinese, Japanese, Native American, European, Mexican, African, Canadian, Puerto Rican, Caribbean, Russian, Australian, or Korean, North or South. We do not care one bit how you wear your trousers, what color you are, or how you do your hair, even though sometimes it is difficult not to find these things interesting. We do not allow guns, cell phone use, or smoking, indoors or on the balcony. Yelling and running are prohibited, except in our children's store where we are unwilling and unable to stop it. We do not allow profanity or other language that may be offensive to other customers. In spite of what some of our lawmakers may lead one to think, people in Mississippi are among the nicest, most hospitable people in America. If you are anyone from anywhere, we hope you will visit us, and we hope you may find something you would like to read. If you do not find the book you want, we will be glad to get it for you. Thank you for visiting Square Books and for being who you are." Those words just take my breath away. And I'm so glad that we get to see that in its entirety in this chapter. It's a powerful testament to not only Richard Howorth, but to many of the others whose stories are part of this book.
Yeah, every community in America needs to have a bookstore that's one in that kind of spirit. It's an amazing community gathering place, and a place where people of every age and every background find something to nurture their souls.
By the way, this is a very different sort of matter, but I don't want to forget to mention it. In this chapter, he also does talk about a lot of the nuts and bolts of what it takes in order for a store like Square Books or Tattered Cover to succeed. And one of the problems is what I think is one point called the occupancy expense conundrum. That is, he says, unfortunately, when a bookstore in a place where rent is affordable opens and then becomes successful, that success generates financial woes. Bookstores are very good traffic builders. And so what he goes on to describe is that what you were saying earlier, an independent bookstore will be a vibrant contributor to a given neighborhood that's maybe rebuilding. But as that neighborhood rebuilds and becomes more robust, the rents go up. And that can be a terrible vice in a sense, an unfortunate price of success for a lot of independent bookstores. It's something I think a lot of us don't stop to think about.
Yeah, it's true. And I have to say, having spent 40 years in the book publishing business, one of the conundrums that we cope with, you know, at every level of books, bookselling and publishing, is the fact that books are such a bargain when it comes to your entertainment dollar. Books, if you consider the number of hours of entertainment and education and just fun that you can get out of a good book, and then compare that with the price of a movie or a streaming TV service, or a live production on Broadway or on the stage, you realize that books are an amazing bargain. And this is, it's a wonderful thing, but it also means that the profit margins for people like booksellers are pretty tight. So whatever any individual can do to support their local bookseller, that's a great thing. There are certainly times when I take advantage of the convenience of Amazon and the other online stores, but I also make a point of supporting independent bookstores as much as possible, because the value that they provide to the community is so great compared to the level of profit that they can experience.
We're speaking with Carl Weber about his book, Why Books Still Matter. Back to the story of Joyce Meskis for a moment. She is ultimately remembered for this gigantic and extraordinary bookstore in downtown Denver. But one of the points that is made by a couple of different contributors to this book is that she did not necessarily harbor ambitions of that scale. I mean, she didn't enter the world of bookselling in order to someday create this gigantic bookstore like nothing the world had ever seen before, and that the growth that happened with the Tattered Cover Bookstore actually was done very incrementally, and I suppose another good adjective or adverb might be organically, and which is probably a very valuable lesson for others wanting to enter this or other businesses. Can you just give us some sense of kind of the growth curve of the Tattered Cover Bookstore and the sort of example that might be for others?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, they did grow quite gradually. And in fact, one of my favorite stories from Joyce's career is about one of the times when they were in the process of moving from one store to a larger one, because they had outgrown the store that they were in, and they simply had too many books that people wanted to be able to buy, and they were devoting a fair amount of space to an auditorium where authors could come and give talks and answer questions and read from their books. So they set a date to move from a smaller space into a larger one, and it was going to be a tremendous job. And what they found was, without asking for it, patrons of the store lined up on the day of the move saying, "How can we help?" And what ended up happening was hundreds of Tattered Cover fans volunteered to spend the moving day helping to schlep cartons of books from the old store to the new store, thereby making the whole shift possible in a single day, which they were expecting to probably have to spend about a week doing. That's the kind of loyalty and love that Joyce and her store had begun to develop, even when they were at a small scale.
By the way, I think one of the really wonderful points raised by John Hickenlooper, Senator Hickenlooper, in his chapter is when he talks about, first of all, wanting to see this success story up close and, actually, in a sense, shadowed Joyce Meskis in her store, volunteered to help with the gift wrapping thing and following the very precise procedures or policies for how that was all handled. I mean, a real testament to Joyce Meskis's eye for detail. But then he points out something that I find just incredible, and that is an instruction that was given to every clerk, and that was had to do with what they were instructed not to say to a customer as a customer was buying a book. Do you remember the moment I'm talking about?
Yes, it's all about making customers feel comfortable and happy no matter what kind of book they're choosing. Why don't you recall, maybe you even have the page open in front of you.
It's basically, clerks were instructed never to proclaim their love for a book being purchased. And so if I went up to the front and I have the latest book by whoever, James Patterson or whoever, and the clerk might say, "Oh, James Patterson, his thrillers are the very best. I love this book, blah, blah, blah." I mean, that might seem like a perfectly fine thing, nice thing to say to a customer buying a book. But Joyce Meskis believed that if you said that to the customer, then the customer standing behind them, how are they going to feel when they walk up with their, how to install a toilet book or whatever they're buying? That would not be received with the same sort of rapturous enthusiasm by the clerk. And of course, at the heart of it is it's not about if the clerk in that moment, it's not about the clerk loves the book. It's the fact that the person loves the book, the customer. And but I just think that really took some wisdom and some vision to think about something as basic as the clerk customer transaction, to think about a detail
That's
like
right.
that.
Wisdom, vision, and also empathy, because you know all of us who are book lovers, we all have our passionate preferences and our love for particular categories or types of books. But Joyce understood that everyone who walked through that door, even someone maybe who had never been in a bookstore before and felt intimidated by the surroundings, needed to be made to feel as though their tastes were just as valuable, just as important as anyone else's. Joyce always remembered what it feels like to be that person, and that they needed to be treated with tremendous respect and dignity, just like anyone else.
I just love that. So let's circle back to something we have already touched on a bit, which was this actually landmark court case that involved the Tattered Cover Bookstore and Joyce Meskis, when an investigation into some criminal wrongdoing was underway. Explain to our listeners what sort of set this in motion and the sort of landmark court case that ultimately ensued.
Sure. Well, it's such an interesting story, Greg. The more you learn about the chilling effect that government intervention can have on reading, the more you realize the different forms that chilling effect can take and has taken over the years. Going back to the 1920s, there was the Red Scare, and there were attempts to regulate the kinds of books that could be sold or distributed through libraries based on their political content. Today, a lot of the books that are being banned by book banners have to do with either race or gender or sexuality. And those are kind of the hot buttons that are being pressed right now. But the landmark case that you referred to back in the year 2000 actually grew out of the war on drugs. And what happened in this particular case was the local government was trying to make a case against a person that they suspected of running a meth lab out of their home. And one of the things they found in this person's home was a receipt from a bookstore, not the Tattered Cover, as it happened, but I think they were a little confused. The police were actually a little confused about this, but they found a receipt for the purchase of a book on how to make meth in a home lab. And so they believed that this customer might have bought the book at the Tattered Cover, and in order to prove that, they actually issued a subpoena, got a judge to sign off on a subpoena demanding this customer's purchase records from the Tattered Cover bookstore. In other words, they wanted the court to be able to see every book that this person had bought over the last 6 months, because they wanted to demonstrate that this person was making an effort to master the art of creating meth. And yes, there have been how-to books published on how to make meth, just as there have been books by would-be anarchists on how to make homemade bombs. And there are certainly books of all stripe publishing all kinds of information and ideas that some of us would find offensive or a bit scary. But Joyce and her team at the Tattered Cover, when they received this subpoena, they immediately went into conference and said, how are we supposed to respond to this? If we release the purchase records from a particular customer, the signal that we'll be sending will be to everyone who comes into this store that any book that you buy, you know, the local government might be able to find out what you've been reading. And, you know, will the information be kept under wraps? Who knows? If you have some opinions or interests that might be considered, you know, beyond the pale or a little bit unusual or unpopular in your community, maybe you need to be a bit worried if subpoenas like this are allowed to go into effect. So Joyce's immediate reaction was to refuse to honor the subpoena. The interesting twist in the case is that her legal team met with her extensively, and as the case was unfolding, her lawyers universally advised Joyce, you know, in this day and age, with the attitude toward drugs that is pervasive in our society, it's very unlikely you're going to be able to win this case. You're not defending a cause that a vast number of people are going to rise up and want to support. You know, everyone agrees that drugs are a scourge on our society. So we think you're better off just folding and giving in to the government. And Joyce quietly said, I understand that the odds are against us winning this case, but this is the right thing to do. And she insisted that they go forward with their appeal, took it all the way up to the Colorado Supreme Court. And sure enough, in the case of Tattered Cover versus Thornton, the Colorado Supreme Court found that there is a constitutionally protected right to privacy regarding information about what we are reading, so that anyone can read any kind of book without feeling that Big Brother is looking over their shoulder. And that's all thanks to Joyce Meskis and her insistence on doing the right thing despite the legal odds being against her.
And of course, one of the most fundamental points that she was making, and there is an essay that is actually in this book that is from Joyce Meskis herself, first published back in 2002, in which she says these very simple words: reading is not a crime. And when we inch towards a scenario in which the simple act of purchasing and reading a given book on whatever it starts to be viewed as a crime or the precursor of a crime, we are really stepping into very, very dangerous territory.
Yes, it's so true. And you know, all of us, no matter what our political or social views, can certainly point to books that we personally are offended by or that we strongly disagree with. So whether you're on the left or the right, you can certainly name, I'm sure, some authors and some topics feel uncomfortable, and that perhaps you would hope that your kids or your friends might not read. And yet, once we go down that slippery slope of giving a government bureaucrat the power to decide, well, this is appropriate, this is not so appropriate, so that fundamental need to make up our own minds and to play the role of citizens in helping to run this society rather than having to yield to government pressure in terms of our opinions, that slippery slope that we begin to travel down is a very dangerous one.
Absolutely. And she goes on to, or actually I'm not sure who it is, but at some point somebody says that there might be something that we view as dangerous or fundamentally destructive, and the temptation in the immediate moment might be to censor that or utterly silence that. And that is not the means by which one should deal with that, because when you do that, it actually remains. It needs to be confronted. It needs to be discussed. It needs to be debated, and that is where truly dangerous, destructive ideas can be met and perhaps rendered, if not out of existence, at least into a place where they are not dangerous to the community. But it's fascinating to think about this whole matter of the freedom to read, the freedom to anonymously purchase a book, the other kinds of related rights that it touches upon.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's true. And one of the things that is most troubling to me about the current wave of book banning, which is largely targeting school libraries, school curriculums, and even public libraries to a lesser extent, though often with children as at least the central focus. One of the most troubling things to me is that the majority of the books that are being singled out by book banners these days are by women and by people of color. You mentioned earlier how Joyce Meskis and a number of other inspiring female leaders were among those who began the process of opening up and revolutionizing the book publishing business starting back in the 1970s. That's a process that continues to this day of the publishing industry in America becoming more and more open to voices of various kinds and experiences and perceptions of differing kinds. And that's a really positive trend that unfortunately some forces in favor of book banning are trying to reverse. So that, for example, the American Library Association every year comes out with lists of the most frequently challenged and the most frequently banned books. And when you look at the list of titles, there are some classics there, whether we're talking about Huckleberry Finn or To Kill a Mockingbird. But there's also a tremendous number of books that are there specifically because they are about the LGBTQ experience or they're about the problems that people of color have experienced. Books such as The Bluest Eye by Toni Morrison is in that list of most frequently challenged books that the AOA has put out. And The Hate U Give by Angie Thomas is another beloved, another Toni Morrison classic, is also frequently challenged. The problem is, I think that for some of the folks who are at the forefront of book banning, I think they feel a little bit uncomfortable with having to share America with certain groups and types of people and trying to silence the voices that express what it's like to be a member of one of these marginalized groups. Trying to silence those voices, that's not the way we're going to overcome division and inequality in our society. I think letting all voices flourish so that we can learn from one another and begin to understand and have empathy for one another, that's the path that I would like our society to go. And I think that's the path that most book lovers want our society to take.
Absolutely. Well, your book goes on to talk about many facets of the book publishing business, including the fact that very few book publishers intend at the outset of their lives to become book publishers. And so the world of book publishing is remarkably varied and much, much more so now than it once was. You also have touched on the fact that the world of booksellers is a generous world by and large. At one point it's read, it's a sector where people share, give away their best business practices. Booksellers openly have donated their successful ideas to those who were, on the face of it, competitors. And the book, your book goes on to also explore the rise of author visits and reading groups and other ways in which the world of books has opened up in marvelous ways. Let me finish out with this quote from Joyce Meskis, who your book honors. "We understand that words and ideas can be powerful. We also know that in varying degrees they can edify, inform, insult, or incur the wrath of the reader. But the cure for a bad idea is not to censor it, because in doing so, it will never go away. The cure is to speak about it, debate it, and gain strength in the wisdom that comes out of discussion." From the Meskis message to our customers, a statement and a promise. Well, that and so many other treasures are to be found in this book, Why Books Still Matter, honoring Joyce Meskis, Essays on the Past, Present, and Future of Books, Bookselling, and Publishing, published by Rivertowns Books, and the editor, Carl Weber. Carl Weber, thank you so much for helping to bring this wonderful book into being, and thank you for being my morning show guest today.
Greg, thank you for having me. What a wonderful conversation.
Tomorrow on the morning show, we'll spend most of the program with Beth Bush, who is the guest director of the Racine Theater Guild, for a wonderful play by Joe DiPietro that opens this weekend, a play called Over the River and Through the Woods. The morning show airs every weekday morning between 8 and 9 o'clock. We will have more lake effect snow through much of the day, and right now it's looking like total accumulation of between 3 to 6 inches, with a high today of 28 degrees. Overnight low all the way down to 12. We should have partly sunny skies tomorrow with a high of 26 degrees. Colder temperatures expected on Wednesday. This is WGTD HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn.